rest of the day. Some drier spells developing, but overall cloudy, and at times that rain will be heavy, 17 to 19 Celsius. The next few days promise a mixture of sunny spells and a few scattered showers, but still warm in the sunshine, just not as hot as it will be on Thursday. That's the forecast.
Thanks, Alex. More sunshine, less rain. Alex Deacon there at the BBC Weather Centre. Now on Radio 4, another extract from The Pink Sari Revolution by Armana Fontanella Khan. Putting her mission to empower women before any family duties, the intrepid vigilante leader Sampat Devi investigates her latest case, which is proving to be a more complex one than a false accusation of theft against an innocent girl by the powerful legislator Dwadi. Mira Sayal is the reader.
Sampat's first matter of business was to find out what Shilu's connection with the legislator was. After leaving the police station, she made her way to Patara, where Shilu had lived before. En route, she went by her family home in Bardausa, which is perched atop a bank of soil a few yards back from the highway. All the houses on this road are joined together in a row and look identical, with sheet metal front doors and flat roofs. Sampat's house differs only in its colour. It is painted pastel pink. This house teems with people at all hours of the day, which partly explains why she rarely spends time here. "This is not a place to do work. That is why I go to my office." Her husband, Munni Lal Pal, her 11 grandchildren, nieces and nephews live in the house, along with four of her five children. "Ah, I have the whole world's kids growing up in my house," Sampat once said with a tired laugh. Now that she's older, Sampat is free to drift in and out of domestic life. She's no longer entangled in maternal duties. "There is no pressure on me from my family. I focus on things that need more attention." When they were young, her children did not understand why Sampat's attention was divided between so many strangers who used to unload their problems onto her. They said, "Are you more concerned with them or us?" Her answer to that was difficult for a child to hear. "I am everyone's mother. I do not put my family first." Her husband, Munni Lal, with his sunken cheeks and several missing teeth, spends most of his waking life sitting sullenly inside the house, shrouded in an enduring, diffident silence. He is resigned to his insignificance. Whenever Sampat returns home, he offers a faint grunt acknowledging her presence. One might say that Munni Lal tolerates the state of affairs, thanks to a feat of self-delusion. "One thing is sure, God has made pairs," he says. "When we are together, there is a feeling of togetherness. We can eat and drink comfortably, sweep the house, have a bath, light two incense sticks, and life goes on nicely," he trails off. Then he recalls that they hardly live together anymore. "It's okay, I work, I eat two roti a day. What more do I need? I have worked hard since the beginning. I have many qualities, you know. It is not that I am sitting here without any qualities." Sampat was only 12 on the day of her wedding. "I didn't know what marriage meant. No one explained it to me. I was enjoying myself that day, playing and eating many, many sweets that people brought. Mother told me, 'Sit down, don't play like this,' but I did anyway. I didn't know anything about what came after," she shrugs. The games ended when, after the wedding, she arrived in the little hamlet of Gadarian Purva to live with her in-laws and her husband. It was much smaller than her parents' village. People were stern, and to her disappointment, "No one was excited that I had arrived." In Gadarian Purva, it was customary for newlywed women to observe Purda, to pull their sari fabric over their faces so they are fully hidden from view. Sampat, unaccustomed to being curtained off from society, would sometimes forget. "But how can you forget?" shrieked her mother-in-law when she first caught her uncovered. "You are acting shamelessly." Glaring at her, Sampat shouted, "Forget it! I'm not doing purda anymore.
What is so wrong with showing my face? Tell me.
Such disputes grew louder and more frequent until the relationship with her in-laws crumbled after she gave birth to her first child, Prabha.
This daughter-in-law is useless. See, she has given us a girl, complained Muni's mother to all who would listen. What's wrong with a woman? You're one, aren't you?
Sampath would retort. Once she regained her strength after the birth, she informed Muni that she was moving out.
If you want to live with me, then it won't be in your parents' house.
This was unheard of in Bundelkhand. Torn between his family and his wife, Muni felt it would go against the laws of nature to live apart from his wife. His agreeing to move out and find a house in another village would mark the beginning of a lifetime of concessions and defeats in their marriage. After giving birth to 5 children, Sampath, still only in her early 20s, was starting to feel suffocated by the restrictions placed on her.
I was cooped up in the house like a rat, she says.
One day, she realized that she had one skill that no one else in Gadarian Purva had. She could sew. That childhood obsession turned out to be a valuable skill. She managed to acquire the money for a sewing machine and became a self-employed seamstress. Soon she was earning as much money as her husband. However, this did not make him amenable to her demands for even more freedom, such as when she wanted to join a local NGO which ran small schools and raised awareness about women's rights. So Sampath went to the organization's meetings without her husband's approval, finding excuses to keep him in the dark.
Nothing he knew. He wasn't letting me go freely at that time, so I tell him, just for him to break my head.
She spoke to the groups of women that gathered at the meetings.
We are strong when we are together. Do you see this hand?
Sampath asked her audience, with her palm open and her fingers splayed, as if about to deliver a slap.
What will hurt more, if you hit someone like this, or,
bringing her fingers together in a fist,
if you hit them like this, she asked, punching the air. This is why we must form groups, huh? Only then will we get our freedom.
Soon enough, Muni found out what she was up to, and would follow her to meetings and shout at her in front of the other women.
Find another husband. I will not keep you.
Sampath shouted back at him.
I am doing this for women and the poor. Who are you? The savior?
Muni snapped, before spinning around to return home fuming. But after this token amount of resistance, Muni left his wife to go forth unhindered, in whichever direction she liked. When Sampath went out to Patra to investigate Shilu's case on December the 14th, 2010, she did not have to get permission from her husband. As soon as she arrived in the village, she went to speak with one of the village elders. From him, she learned that the young girl had come to live here with her young lover, Raju, against her family's will. Evidently, Shilu's father, Acce, a widow who was at his wit's end with his teenage daughter, had asked the local legislator, Dwivedi, to help him to extricate the girl from this shameful situation. Dwivedi said that he would take care of things and came with his muscle men. When they couldn't find Shilu, they found Raju's father and dangled him over the well in front of his house until he confessed that the girl was hiding in an outhouse nearby. The men dragged her out of there, shoved her into a jeep, and sped off. Sampath made her way back to Adara, and when she came to Dwivedi's house, she pressed her face to the window to look inside, as she imagined what might have gone on behind those walls. He lived in a 3-story house on the main street, not far from the Pink Gang's headquarters. The exterior was eggshell colour with black stripes resembling prison bars. There was a satellite dish and a flag with a swastika, a Hindu symbol ubiquitous in India that is considered auspicious. When Shilu's father told her she would be living there now, she started to cry.
This is a legislator's house, Shilu. It will turn out good for you here,
Acce remembers telling his daughter. Dwivedi turned to her and said with some finality, Daughter, you are staying here. He then promised Ache that apart from housing Shilu, he would also arrange for her marriage, not only finding a suitor, but also helping to provide a dowry. This was the offer that disarmed Ache. He feared that after going with Raju, his daughter would never be married off, as she would now be considered spoiled goods. A man took Shilu up to her room, a windowless bare space with a solitary red bulb hanging from the ceiling and a small TV in the corner. She curled up and went to sleep on a bed with no blanket, taking the shawl she was wearing and wrapping it tightly around her. When she woke, it was early afternoon. Her first thought was, "When will my father take me away from here?" She ventured downstairs, where she met the legislator's wife, a middle-aged woman called Asha. They exchanged a few pleasantries and she was given something to eat before going back to her room. On Shilu's second night at Dwivedi's house, she alleges that the politician came up to her room after she had gone to bed. He asked her how she was settling in. She said she wanted to go back to her father's house, but Dwivedi told her that this was her new home. Then he informed her of the marriage he was arranging for her with his servant, Chedhi. He lived a serf-like existence in the house, and the idea that she might marry him revolted Shilu. Her rejection angered the legislator. He barged out of the room, and she knew this wouldn't be the last she heard about this matter. The next day, when Dwivedi was out, Shilu slipped downstairs and met his wife again, who prepared the girl a meal and waited on her, refilling her dish generously when she'd finished each serving. Her motherly doting put Shilu at ease, and she told Asha about the marriage plans for her and Chedhi. Asha's face grew stern.
"Don't you agree to it? You understand me? Say no."
When Shilu asked if Asha could help dissuade her husband, she allegedly refused. After dinner, Shilu retired to her room to plan how she might escape this house. As she lay in bed thinking about what to do, the door opened suddenly. It was Dwivedi. He told Shilu again that he was arranging for her to marry Chedhi. When she refused, he started beating her. Trying to escape, she ran to the bathroom next door, but before she could close the door, he thrust his arm through the crack and grabbed her. The next minute, she says, she was up against the wall with his thick-fingered hands clamping her mouth shut. He told her again she would marry Chedhi. "And when you do, we will both be screwing you." He led her to the bed, keeping her mouth covered. Shilu's throat was too tightly knotted to scream. Dwivedi reached for the remote control on Shilu's bedside table and turned on the television, pushing up the volume until the room was reverberating with shrill voices advertising the latest consumer products in Hindi. Shilu alleges that after that first night she was raped, he violated her another time the next day. At around 3 in the morning on December the 13th, when Shilu says he tried to rape her a third time, she sees the opportunity to escape.
"He was in the bathroom. I thought, this is my chance."
She fled, taking with her a mobile phone, and made her way southeastward on foot, down the unlit roads. Her father was called to Atara, and it was then he was threatened and dangled over the fire. Shilu was caught in the village of Dura, a few miles from Atara, after Dwivedi located her by tracking his mobile phone.
"They took me to the police station and accused me of being a thief."
At the time, the newspaper The Hindustan noted the veil of secrecy being drawn around Shilu's arrest.
"What is going on? Normally when the police arrest thieves, they proudly parade their catch. Why not with this girl?"
It would be some time before those questions were answered.
Meera Sayal was reading from The Pink Sari Revolution by Armana Fontanella Khan. The book is abridged by Eileen Horn, produced by Clive Brill, and is a Pacificus production for BBC Radio 4. Now the shipping forecast, issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Thursday, the 1st of August. The general synopsis at 1800. Low Shannon, 1000, expected Malin, 995 by 1800 Thursday. The area forecast for the next 24 hours. Viking, north at Sierra, south at Sierra. Variable, becoming easterly or southeasterly, 3 or 4, increasing 5 or 6 later, occasional rain, fog patches later, moderate or good, occasionally very poor later. 40s, Cromarty, 4th, Tyne, Dogger. East or southeast, veering south or southeast, 4 or 5, increasing 6 for a time, rain for a time, fog patches, moderate or good, occasionally very poor. Fisher, German Bight, southwest, becoming cyclonic, then